Session number 21554, Reel 7.
I wanted to ask you, the situation that you explained to us, you were in for sort of 28 days, I think you were mentioning, how that sort of affects you?
At the time? Well, I don't know, I can't give you a very true story in that, John, just the days passed. After Shaky Burwell, Mincy Dunnell, after he died, the chaplain was telling me, chaplain of the 2nd 14th Battalion, there was only one of them, he was a West Australian. He was put alongside me, and he helped me a lot, only as much as he was a noisy big bugger. And he could sing, or pretty rough voice, and he was wounded in the leg. It was a strange thing. They reckon he was, as if you would do that for 28 days, when he got back here, they reckon he was putting it on. He'd got a mortar blast in the leg, but there was nothing really to show for it. But the nerve was dead. He finished up with his leg in calipers, you know. And he was a noisy big bugger and very humorous, and he would crawl, and he'd get out of his blanket and go away and do his toiletries, whatever he had to do in the bush. And he'd come back, and he'd shake his blanket and get the dirt out of it, and then he'd crawl back into it. And of course, by the time he crawled back into it, it'd be just as much, if not more, dirt than what it was before he shook it out. And even though I know it almost sounds childish, but even the bloody noise he would make and the insults he'd put the Japs for putting him into that position, but it was done in almost a humorous way. But the things like that, I think, had a lot to do with helping me in the finish. There were odd times, even in my own case, that things were unusual. Because of the shock to that part of my body, I'm backtracking a bit here now, but I had been on the stretcher, I think I was on the stretcher for best part of a week before I passed water. The shock and my penis had disappeared because I had the flesh taken off the right scrotum, and that was an unusual thing. But I spoke to my medical man about it, and he said it's amazing just how long you can go without passing water, just builds up inside you. Another story, while I was on the stretcher, and I'd been on it for a few days, and because your chaps carrying you had such a hell of a job carrying you, you didn't like to ask them for favours. And I forget now, it might have been 4, 5, 6 days, I said to one of these chaps, when you put me down, do you think you could roll me over on the side? I said, I think I've either got a bit of stone or a stick on my blanket and it's sticking into me at the back. And so when they put me down, he rolled me over, and I heard him laugh. I said, something about it's not funny from this angle. He said, well, it's funny when you say it's a bit of a stick of a stone. He said, you've got a bullet hole on your back. And this about 5 days after. There was so much attention given to the front where it had blasted out that they hadn't even done anything to the back of me where it had gone in. I mean, this just gives you some idea of the conditions that warfare is conducted under. You know? Imagine someone here been shot, and about 5 days later find out that there was a bullet hole that they hadn't intended there. Anyway, another thing that happened, I mentioned when I was on the stretches, because of the shock to that part of the system and the fact that we had practically no food, I went 14 days without using my bowels. In fact, in the 28 days I was out, I only used them 3 times. This might sound pretty strange. People go here for 2 days and they panic a bit and they want to get a opening medicine. And of course, after 14 days, and I said to the two chaps looking after us, and I thought I might want to use my bowels. Of course, not much they could do for me. They took my stretcher out and a fallen log, and they put it up against a log. Well, I had to try and hold myself over the side of the log to help myself, and in the condition I was in, wasn't much good. So it was a pretty difficult way of attending to your toiletries. I'm just mentioning this on the side. Things were pretty difficult. But I never ever felt any panic or thought that you weren't ever going to be found. I don't know whether the two chaps looking after us did, because they, perhaps because they were fit, they might have thought about it, I don't know.
You mentioned that you didn't think of God or religion that much. Did it ever go through your mind, what's it all about, you know? Is there a God?
No, I never thought of it. No, I didn't think about it along those lines. No, I think most people probably would think that, well, you're up there, it's either you or he. And I never ever thought of it that way, that anyone has done this. Although I suppose, in a way, you should, because when you think of the number of close calls I had, plus the fact that as a kid I had tetanus, and to survive that was I'm talking about 75 years ago when I had tetanus, or 76 years ago, to survive that was pretty unusual. So perhaps my number wasn't wanted on the difference. I feel sure, when you see what's happened to different people, when I see how close a shave I had on so many occasions, the fact that when I was first hit and didn't take the artery, when the doctor said they couldn't understand why, when I can't stand up and they have another go at me, and different things like that, perhaps you should stop and think, well, either that or us, you know. I'm a fatalist that way, that I think that if you are wanted, because I've seen, I heard one chap at Tobruk stood up, wasn't even near where there was anything going on, he thought, and I believe he copped a little bit of shrapnel, about as big as a fingernail, and he got in the heart, and he was a man who was, in fact, he was a heavyweight champion boxer of Western Australia. When I was a big lump of a chap. His number was on that little bit of lead, you know, so I suppose you should think along those lines. But I don't think I thought about that so much as then, didn't think of it then, but I think I have thought of it since then, that that wasn't what you were wanted for.
The fact that you've got mates around you, what sort of bonds developed in that stressful situation?
Oh, tremendous. Yeah. I think any mates that's in the army, I've often said this to people, that in the army you have mates, in civilian life you have friends. I think it's just a difference. And even with some of the mates you have in the army, some of the things they might have done weren't perhaps what should be done, but you're more inclined to make excuses for them than what you do. But I've always felt that way. There's a difference between mateship and friendship. And, well, even my wife, I've heard her talking to other ladies of the our association, how we stick together. It is a different setup to ordinary friendship.
Tell us then about your relief.
Oh well, it was about 28 days when we picked up, and when we were being carried, because we still weren't given anything to eat, because we'd been so long without food that all we got was a hot drink of Bovril or something like that, you know, for the first couple of days. And then, of course, we eventually finished up getting into hospital in Moresby, and I'd been there a couple of days, and little humorous things had come to me at the time. I was, because we didn't have any female nurses in Moresby at the time, they were all male nurses, and we had sheets, white sheets and white pillowcases, and I'm lying on my bed, and I must have been starting to feel a bit better and give a bit of cheek. Oh, sorry, looking the wrong way. I must have been feeling a little bit better and giving a bit of cheek. I did that just now, so I rolled different ways. And as my head was on the white pillowcase, I saw something move on the pillowcase, you know, a little insect. And then I saw another one, and I rolled up the other side, and I saw another one. And I said to the male nurse, when I came along, I said, you've got bugs in this joint. And he said, we didn't have the bastard there before you came in here, because we were such a mess and so dirty that we must have had crabs, whatever in on your body, in your hair. Yeah. So that was the expression he said to me. But as a matter of fact, I even then, because of my condition being on my back, they couldn't wash me properly or wash my hair. And it wasn't until I got to Sydney that ever was washed. I'm jumping ahead a bit now, only because I'm mentioning my hair, because when I was in the hospital in Urala, Concord Hospital, Urala, in Sydney, these chaps came round to the hospital, barbers, you know, cut your hair, and they said, you obviously need a haircut. Well, by this time, I don't know, you know, I suppose it was, I don't know, 2 or 3 months, be more than that, but since I'd had a haircut. He said, you like a shampoo? I said, yeah, and so he shampooed my hair, and you wouldn't think that would be like that. I said, if you'd been where I would, because the colour of the water was nearly brown. I said, if you'd been where I was, you'd know it would be like that. So that's I know that's jamming your head a bit, but in Moresby, in the hospital, the head serang of the hospital was marvellous to us because of the what we'd been through, and he was like we were his own sons. He treated us so well. In fact, I remember him saying to me, Jim, when you get back to Perth, into Hollywood Hospital, don't because when the bullet hit the bone that I sit on, it took quite a chunk out of the bone. Luckily, it didn't break it, because I probably would have died of pain had it broken, you know, if you'd had a broken hip or something. But the bullet broke up too. That's why it made such a mess coming out, and there's quite a bit of lead still in my hip. And he said to me, now, when you get back there, don't let them try and get that lead out. He said, because the hip is so big, he said, all they'll do would be make a mess here, and they could do more harm than good. And the little bits of lead are still there, about a dozen of them. In fact, I've had x-rays for various reasons since, with a crooked back, etc., etc. And I usually get the person comes back and say, look, have you had a lot of x-rays recently? I said, no, why? Because I don't tell them straight away. Well, there's something wrong with your x-ray. I said, has it got a little white, lot of white dots on it? Yeah, about a dozen. I said, lead, bits of lead. So I always have to tell them the story, because it still shows up in the x-ray. But in the hospital, we were really looked after. And there was one chap there, and how you think of mates, not that I knew him, but he'd been shot in the liver. And, of course, as a result of that, he contracted malaria, dysentery, anything that was going, he got it. And I think everyone in the ward, because although you weren't well, you were better than he was, and you sort of fought for him. And when we came home on the Mananda, they got him well enough to put him on the Mananda, but he didn't make it. They had to bury him at sea, unfortunately.
How long had it taken you to get from your position back to Moresby?
31 days.
From the time that you were
released? I think about 3 days. I think it was 31 days, 8th September, 8th October inclusive, and I think about 28 days before we were picked up.
What were the feelings then on being relieved?
Relief. I cried. I don't mind admitting it. When I saw these two chaps of this patrol, and they were, I think they were mostly 2nd 27th chaps, but two of them in the front were from my own battalion, and they were two chaps I knew personally. And when I saw them, I couldn't help it, I cried. And I think it was fair enough, and probably the other blokes with me cried too. I was going to say something, and that's the time when one thought comes, another one goes away, doesn't it? Anyway, I forget now.
What were your feelings on the situation at the time, the job that you had done?
As a soldier?
On your return back to Moresby, what were your feelings?
Oh, just relief at getting back, having been found and getting into hospital. Something I remember about, I mentioned earlier in the piece that when we arrived in Moresby, the terrible conditions of the road, and we had to push our own trucks in the mud. And when we came back, of course, this was because the Americans were there then with all their earth-moving equipment. And in that short, comparatively short time that I'd been away, it was like a six-lane highway that we drove on. But then we came back because they had all the big earth-moving equipment.
By September 18th, there had been the Japanese withdrawal from Imita Ridge. And they'd actually gotten quite close to Port
Moresby.
Yeah,
40 k's.
What was the feeling then of having been involved in halting the Japanese?
I can't say I really thought about it at all at that stage, John. I think it was just that your own condition, and back in hospital, you knew you were finished, and that was that. You knew that there was nothing else you could do about it at all. Actually, there was the officer who went looking for the bag of mail and got lost, happened to be in the hospital when I got there, Bert Madigan, something we always had as a bond because we're both in hospital together. And I'd had a gutful, naturally, by the way I felt, and this was only the day after I got back in the hospital, and Bert came to see me, heard I was in there, and he had about 20 flesh wounds from a shell burst or a grenade or something. And Bert couldn't get back quick enough, and I thought, bloody hell, I said, I've had enough for now, and he can't get back up there quick enough. But that's, you were so run down that there was no thought of wanting to get back into it at that stage, that was for sure.
What was the feeling in the hospital amongst the chaps that were there?
It was pretty good, pretty bright. Well, I suppose by the time I got to hospital, the Japs had been pushed back by this time. Had been well pushed back, because that was probably a couple of weeks after that. Would you say 18th of September? And see, this was the 8th of October, so things were good then, and bombing had finished in Moresby and everything by that. And the feeling was quite good in the hospital. Unfortunately, the only unfortunate thing in the hospital was that some of the young chaps, or a couple of them, that were in our ward from the 53rd Battalion, and what we call an SIW, a self-inflicted wound. And even then, the medical officer in charge, and he used to come out to this young bloke that was opposite me in the ward, and he'd say, "Well, what's your story today?" He'd had a bullet wound in his hand, and apparently, from what they said, he must have, which I still think seems to take a lot of guts to shoot yourself, he must have shot himself in the other hand. But unfortunately, when he used to tell the story to them, he used to, because it wasn't true, the way he was trying to tell the story, he was telling a lie. And even then, I think that because of his comparative youth, this medical officer used to try and help him a bit and say, "Well, what story are you going to tell me today?" He used to apparently forget some of the details of how he got shot. And then he apparently shot himself.
Which, how were people like that seen by the rest?
Well, I didn't worry about them. Well, that was their business. So it was bad enough getting shot by someone else without shooting yourself. And it's surprising, really, surprising how many people do survive. My own elder brother survived right through for the 5 years and never got wounded. And he wasn't the sort of bloke that would dodge anything, because he was really a tough guy. And in fact, some of the stories I've heard about him without seeing it myself, you know, he wouldn't be trying to dodge anything, but he survived right through without getting hurt. He got terribly with dysentery and malaria and things like that. He suffered a lot because you had to, more or less, if you went through those conditions in Syria and in Ghana. But I didn't worry much about the SIWs. That's the way they feel about it. That's their business. And he probably got discharged, you know, doing the wrong
dishonourable
thing. Dishonourable discharge, probably, when he got back to Australia. Pretty hard on those young blokes, you know, that went there. As I said, he'd have been a 53rd bloke, because the 39th was such a great unit. In fact, I mentioned it before, that when they wanted to relieve the 39th, they didn't want to go back. They knew it was bad, things were bad, and they knew that every standing man could be helped. Whereas with the 53rd, Brigadier Potts told them to get out, because they'd let us down. He told them to get out, and I think they went back and carried stores and perhaps stretchers or something like that. He didn't want to have them, the responsibility of them, to let them down again. Yeah.
What does it mean to you to have been involved in the operation of the Kokoda Track?
Oh, it's a great honour. I feel it was a great honour. I know maybe they boost it up a little bit when they say, you know, compare with Gallipoli. I don't think personally there can be any comparison whatsoever. It's just, I think it's the fact that they got so close. And had it not been for the for what did happen, and although we only held them up for a couple of weeks, that was long enough for the 25th Brigade to come up. Had we stood and fought at Alola, Abuari and the Shirava, those places where the 39th, 2nd, 14th and so on, had we stood and fought there, we'd have been cleaned up, no doubt. And they would have had an open go, because I think their plans were to get to Moresby in about a week or 10 days or something. There wouldn't have been anyone to stop them. The only other battalion there was the 2nd 27th, and one battalion wasn't going to stop them then. They might have stopped them for one day. So that although ours didn't sound so good in the first place, because we had to withdraw, because we'd hold them up a day at a time and 3 days at Brigade Hill, it gave them time for the 25th Brigade to come up. And I know that, and of course, John, when the Japs had to pull out, when we started off, our lines of communication were this long, theirs were this long. But by the time that they'd finished at Ubiwa, they'd gone through what we went through, and our fresh blokes had just come up fresh to attack them. So, yeah, the boot was on the other foot. That's even if they hadn't been told to pull out, they'd have been gone by then. Because they couldn't, it was an utter impossibility for them to have kept going. But had they gone through in the first place, had we not had these, held them up for those couple of weeks, I know it doesn't sound a long time, there would have been nothing between them and Moresby. And once they hit out over Ubiwa, they'd have had down on the flats, and they'd have been in Moresby that day. So it makes you feel good to know that you were a part of it. You don't lord yourself about it. I mean, you have it within yourself and amongst your mates. You don't even really talk about that angle, but it does. When other people say it to you, you know, you must be pretty pleased. Well, you think to yourself, oh, well, I did help. I did try and help a little bit. So it does make you feel good in that respect. And these couple of things have been on, like when we're invited to go to the Dockers football match because of the Kokoda track and the Tobruk veterans, when you invite there and see the reception that we got from the 38,000 people there, it's a wonderful feeling. As a matter of fact, the Dexia Theatre people who put on that show were wonderful, and they thought we were wonderful, but it was just we were just as thrilled as what they were. I explained to the lasses, they said, yeah, that was marvellous. I said, well, we feel it was too. We were just as thrilled to do what they asked us to do. And matter of fact, I just got a letter today inviting us up to the DVA on the 27th of this month to have morning tea with them as a thank you for being part of it. But it does. It's not your ego. It gives you a lift. And my own grandsons were at the game, and I knew where they were stationed, just where we were coming off the oval, and I was able to go like that to them. It's good.
One of the questions that people, as I understand, on the Kokoda track were to ask the medics was, have I got a homer?
Yeah, I know what you mean, yeah. But I'd never heard that expression.
You had one?
No, I had one, I never thought about it. Mine was too bad, you know. I never thought of it that way. In fact, I never even gave any thought to where I'd be. Well, I was in hospital and I got that in the 8th of September. I didn't get finished up with hospital until about the middle of the next year. So no way that I wasn't a homer, but I didn't think of it as being such. I knew I was a mess. That was it.
I wanted to discuss with you the sort of psychology that someone in your situation has to adopt. You're in the jungle, it's hot, you're in a traumatic situation with a gaping wound. People seem to worry about such little things these days in comparison. How do you sort of get over that? How do you cope with that?
Well, I've never really thought about it, John. It's just your natural makeup, I suppose. I might relate to a bit of a story about one of the chaps who looked after us, John Burns. Although there were only three of us from the 2nd 16th Battalion and one from the 2nd 14th, all the others were 2nd 27th Battalion wounded, and these two chaps who looked after us were from that battalion. Actually, I was the only survivor of my group. This chap went to no end of trouble after the war to try and contact me. He wrote to me in Bunbury, where I had originally worked but never went back to. And he made two trips over here to the west. And he said, and the main reason he came over was to try and contact me. And I said, well, why did you go to so much trouble when you had so many mates and so many 2nd 27 chaps in South Australia with you, you could have contacted and discussed what happened to us? And he said, well, I'm not trying to put a feather in my own cap, but he said, well, you were the only one of the group that never once complained and were always so cheerful about things. I said, well, I didn't do it on purpose, but how could you complain when blokes have put their lives on the line to help you? Why would you complain to them? I mean, it just doesn't sound reasonable. But I suppose that's your own makeup. You can't help it. Of course, when you say how you feel about these things, I never ever thought of dying, except for that one day when I told you about the chap's face was blown alongside me. I never ever thought of that, and that was just something I think was going to happen. I had no say over. I never thought about dying or the future. I never thought I might lose my leg. But when I eventually got into hospital in Moresby, the head medical officer there remarked to me one day, he said, Jim, I suppose you, and when I say Jim, it's just how he spoke to us, he was like a father and son. He said, I suppose you used to worry when you were lying out there all that time that you'd get gangrene. I thought, God, fortunately I didn't worry, didn't think about that, because had I thought about that, it could have been the end of the road. I would have probably gone off my block worrying about the fact that I was so far up my leg that I couldn't have my leg taken off or something. But I never thought that way. He said, well, to be quite honest, the only reason you didn't get gangrene is because the whole time you're out there, the wound never stopped suppurating. That means that it kept on discharging all the time. Because it was discharging, no muck could get into the wound. Admittedly, I was pretty badly burnt around the bottom of my thigh and that, but I just never thought about the fact, and I never thought about the fact that we wouldn't get found and get picked up. I never sort of looked that far into the future, John. So, yeah, it is.
Did you think of home when you were out in the jungle?
No, I don't think I did, particularly. It sounded a bit rough, but I don't think I did really think along those lines. Of course, it's 60 years ago. It's a long time to remember, just what you thought. But what I have said about the wound part, well, you can't forget about those things, because they're just that sort of thing that always was in you, still in your mind, because you were so lucky. That's fate.
I wanted to ask you, you mentioned that you've been relieved, and what was the journey home from your position to Port Moresby like? I mean, you mentioned having to climb up and down hills.
Yeah, well,
was this a similar situation?
No, I don't think it was, because when they were carrying us, they'd come in a very roundabout way. They hadn't come directly over the ranges. There must have been an easy way around to the point where we were, because I don't remember that part. I don't remember any real difficulty in them carrying us when we were going back to Moresby.
You mentioned also about being in hospital in Moresby. In Moresby, what was the feeling towards you in relation to what you'd achieved?
Because of what we'd been through.
Well, what you'd helped in achieving, stopping the Japanese.
Oh, I can't say there was any real feeling about that at all, John. Not really.
Tell us about the trip home then.
Well,
what was the situation? What was the ship you came back on?
In Moresby Hospital itself, I suppose, as I forget the exact period of time, we were there probably for a couple of weeks or more, and then we were put aboard the hospital ship Manunda. We went from Moresby down to Melbourne Bay and picked up the wounded from there, and then we came through to Sydney. We were the first wounded to come back from New Guinea to Sydney. Prior to that, they'd only gone to Brisbane. And
what was the feeling amongst the wounded on board ship?
Well, you were just in your own. You didn't move around because you're in a cot, on your own more or less. So, in fact, I don't think I could even speak to the blokes in the other cots, because you're in a high-sided cot. So you didn't really mix. You didn't. I mean, it wasn't like you're not. This is not on tape now. It's not like being on an ordinary ship where you're moving about, but you were just lying in a cot, like lying in a hospital bed, but more confined because you haven't got the room on it. So you didn't have any conversation with anyone apart from the nurses and doctors who came and spoke to you.
What were they telling you about your situation and how you would be? Did they have any idea of your future for you?
No, not at all. No, not from memory. I don't think they get discussed that at all, John. And we arrived in Sydney. There was a bit of euphoria on the wharf then, because I remember there were quite a lot of people, because we were the first. They must have known we were coming, and some let them. And in fact, I think I might have even been the first patient ashore, because I know that they took my photo at the bottom of the gangway with a young female person handing me a camp comforts issue of some sort, which is the sort of thing you got occasionally when you're away. I remember the cameraman saying, "Don't look at her, look at me, I'm the one that's taking your photo." So there must have been a bit of sort of euphoria about it. From there we went to hospital in Urala Hospital. That was the Army Hospital in Sydney at West Concord. There for a few weeks, and it was while I was there that I actually got back onto my feet for the first time. And
after how long?
I was a month on the stretcher. That would have probably been about 2 months, I suppose, by that time, at least 2 months.
In the hospital, what was the feeling amongst the men towards the ongoing war around you?
I don't know.
In other parts of the world, obviously.
Yeah. Well, I can't remember anything particularly about that, but I do remember that a lot of, and this is not being negative towards them, because the militia had done such a wonderful job in New Guinea, the 39th Battalion. But when I could get on my feet, and then I could go down to the mess place for meals, one of our own battalion chaps who'd come either on another ship after me, because this was some weeks later, or maybe he came down by plane, I forget, but he had a very bad arm wound, which was in plaster, which they used to leave them there, and they'd sort of go rotten, but that was part of the makeup of fixing him up. And every time he moved his arm, it used to smell. And I noticed that when I went there, I didn't know him personally, but I saw his colour patch, and I went and sat with him, but the younger people here who had not been to the war, if you like, in action, none of them would sit near him because he smelled so much. I thought that was pretty offensive.